This is Christina Feldman on Saturday, the 21st of April.
In the talk this afternoon, I'd like to just reflect a little bit more upon the Satipatthana Sutta that I referred to this morning, the discourse containing the four foundations of mindfulness. Can you hear me all right if I just speak at this level? Okay, I don't have to shout. So sati, often translated as mindfulness or translated as awareness, is really, of course, very central to the whole range of meditative paths that were taught by the Buddha. Now, the primary kind of exploration of what sati means is found in this discourse, this teaching called the Satipatthana Discourse, which deeply emphasizes mindfulness or sati as a path to liberating insight. Now, mindfulness is actually, again, we don't really have the English words to translate many Pali words. So mindfulness is a little bit of a limited translation of what sati is. Sometimes it's translated as to place mindfulness within, or to attend to, or to be present with mindfulness. Sometimes sati is translated as to stand near, or to stand by. And this discourse, the Satipatthana Sutta, begins with a very powerful statement. It begins by saying, there is bhikkhus, monks and nuns, the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for attaining the way, for the realization of liberation, nibbana. Namely, this path is the four Satipatthana, the four foundations of awareness. Now, these four Satipatthanas, often translated as foundations or bases, are the places that we establish mindfulness within our bodies, within feeling, within our minds, and within what is called the Dhammas. All the factors that shape the mind, either towards liberation or towards suffering. And the Buddha talks about, he says, what are these four? A bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He, she abides contemplating feelings as feelings, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He or she abides contemplating mind as mind, the Dhammas as the Dhammas, ardent, fully aware, and mindful. I'll go into these a bit. This is a little bit more of a technical talk. I hope you'll bear with me. The meditation practice or insight practice is really dedicated to this contemplation. Now, the Buddha also ended this discourse with some equally powerful words. He said, if anyone should develop these four foundations for 7 years, for 7 months, for 7 weeks, even for 7 days, they will come to know direct realization of profound liberation. Seems a really rather grandiose promise. So this describes a journey that is not only liberating, but in fact, this path is also very challenging. And in some ways, this path is almost, I would say, designed to make us a little uncomfortable. Although certainly the path is designed to cultivate a very deep sense of inner ease, inner peace, inner well-being, at the same time, it is meant to challenge us. It is meant to kind of take us out of our comfort zones and challenge many of the assumptions and many of the belief systems that we have. Now, this discourse, in a way, holds the whole of the Buddhist teaching within it. And in the time and the context that it was given, it was a very radical teaching. And I think in our time and context, it actually continues to be a radical teaching. I think it's important to remember the context in which this particular path began. I mean, the Buddha grew up in a time, in a spiritual and a religious climate particularly, that really taught transcendence as being the path to liberation. So the body, mind, feelings, emotions, relationships, in fact, pretty much all of life were essentially seen as being a problem, an obstacle to freedom, or hindrances to be overcome, or to be suppressed, or to be annihilated. And in the early years of his own practice, Siddhartha really cultivated that ethos. It really guided his path. You know, he starved and abused his body, apparently, till he could press on his navel and touch his spine. He left his family. He left his identity. He left his world. In fact, he even named his son Fetter. And he went really to great lengths to suppress his mind and to disconnect from the world. Now, when we look back at that from our standpoint today, that might seem incredibly weird and alien and, you know, completely out of context for us, but I don't think it is. I think on more moderate levels, culturally, we actually tend to practice exactly the same ethos. You know, how do we get rid of this life that's a problem? How do we distance ourselves from things? How do we push things away? How do we suppress? How do we get rid of the imperfect? It's not such, you know, look at our advertising. You know, recently I remember looking at an ad on TV and it said, you know, perfection is every woman's right. Wait a minute. You know, wherever we can laugh, but somehow we would really like it, wouldn't it? You know? And so we do a lot to kind of push away everything that is unpleasant. We have a very, very low tolerance level for discomfort. And we do go to great lengths to avoid it. How many of us find ourselves in those thoughts that if only I had a different body, or a different mind, or a different personality, or a different relationship, or a different life, if only I had a different car, then I would be happy. You know, then I would be lovable. Then I would be worthy. It seems to me that there is a kind of timelessness to resistance and aversion. Then Siddhartha had this kind of major revelation, which was a turning point in his journey, where he came to understand deeply the futility of all of these strategies of resistance and transcendence. Nagarjuna, who was a great Indian writer, he said, "What do we do with a life that doesn't go away?" And I think the path of insight teaches us that the first thing that we do is to stop wanting it to go away. As Siddhartha came to understand that the classroom of his awakening and that the classroom of compassion lay within all that he had previously disdained and rejected and condemned and fled from. So there was this kind of circle. He came back to where he began, came back to his body, came back to feelings, came back to his mind, came back to all of the factors that shaped his mind, the four foundations of mindfulness. Now this story of ceasing to flee, of ceasing to disconnect and resist, I think describes a very crucial change of attitude, which is really at the heart of wise mindfulness. The idea, the belief in things being a problem, an obstacle, impossible, are seen differently. The experiences of pain and sorrow and grief and suffering are embraced in a different way, not as being imperfections to fix or get rid of, not as being personal failures, and that the end of struggle and sorrow is not projected into some future ideal moment. But instead, mindfulness is an encouragement to be really a path to the present, a path to what is already here, and learning what it means, actually, to bring understanding into the places where there's confusion, to discover peace in the midst of agitation and anxiety, to nurture compassion in the midst of disconnection, and to nurture freedom in the very places where we feel the most bound and contracted. It is a shift from transcendence to immanence. Now the Satipatthana Sutta begins with this very simple acknowledgement that there is sorrow, there is grief, there is unsatisfactoriness in life. Equally, the acknowledgement that there is the possibility of freedom. Now, this beginning of sorrow and the end of sorrow captures the most simple core of the Buddha's teaching, where he says, "I teach just one thing, that there is suffering and that there is an end of suffering." Now this beginning and end of suffering is contemplated on a moment-to-moment level through the path of mindfulness and contemplation. Now in this context, mindfulness then is not a destination. Mindfulness is not a vehicle that takes us from suffering to freedom. Wise mindfulness is not an end in itself. But wise mindfulness is a means to an end. Wise mindfulness is a means to insight and to understanding. And it is the insight and the understanding which brings about the end of struggle. It's the insight and understanding which is the cause of freedom. Now what is referred to in the Satipatthana Sutta is not just mindfulness itself, but the cultivation of wise mindfulness. Now, wise mindfulness is shaped by many things. It's shaped by ethics, by integrity. It's shaped by clear intention. Wise mindfulness is shaped by investigation and by wisdom. So in this sense, mindfulness is not neutral. I mean, mindfulness we can see in our life, it's not difficult to see, can take many forms and be informed by many, many different factors and by a whole range of motivations. You know, when I think of the couple of times in my life when I've been burgled, I would say my burglar was incredibly mindful. Not caring or sensitive, but really, really attentive to detail. Details that were hidden away in various drawers, but very, very attentive to detail. If you look at a hunter, it's very mindful, very attentive. So is the hunted. Their motivations may be very different, yet they can be acutely married by mindfulness. Someone who is a surgeon, someone who is a patient in the midst of a great illness, can be very, very mindful of what is actually happening in the moment. But the mindfulness, again, is not necessarily shaped by compassion or by ethics or by investigation. So there's a real question, is mindfulness intrinsically liberating? Mindfulness itself, does it lead to the highest happiness and peace? I mean, I'm sure my burglar had a transient happiness, but I really doubt whether it was an enduring liberation. So I don't think it is. I don't think mindfulness in itself, without the context of ethics, investigation, wise intention, is necessarily liberating. Mindfulness rests upon the context of being dedicated to the end of suffering, to the end of pain, the context of being dedicated to liberation. Now, wise mindfulness carries one element, one of the elements of it is bare attention, as I spoke about this morning, bringing a clear, a calm, a gentle, an affectionate, a tender attentiveness to every moment we experience. Now that bare attention, flavored by those qualities, is not in the business of being judgmental. It's not in the business of being reactive. It is simply in the business of knowing the moment as it is. Now the purpose of that bare attention is to illuminate the moment. It is to bring what is happening out of the shadows and into the forefront of our consciousness, the forefront of awareness. It's to enliven the moment. And if I could give you a sort of example of that, I think I've maybe mentioned this before, but years ago when I went to teach in Arizona, because everybody had told me how amazing the desert was, that, you know, with all this anticipation of, in myself, of going to see this amazing desert, that I got up in the morning and went outside, you know, waiting to be awed and stunned and all those things, and I looked around and I thought, it's just brown. Just brown, you know, like what is this amazing desert, you know. And then I just noticed that over the days being there, really paying attention, really continuing to pay attention, how, in a way, how almost the desert revealed itself. All the changing colors and the shifting light, all the creatures. It was actually really pretty amazing. But without attention, without wise attention, it was brown. Now, you will notice the same effect for yourself many, many times in your life. You may have experienced it today. that you can walk outside. And if the mind is really just lost in its own swirling thoughts, or, you know, half asleep, or, you know, preoccupied with one thing or another, the world is really just a backdrop to the activities of our mind. And it actually doesn't touch us. Yet if we slow down a little and go on exactly the same walking path and really, really pay attention, it is like walking into a different world. It's like walking into a world that is alive. You see the flowers on the trees. You see the grass becoming greener. You see the world coming to life in spring. And it is the same world. It's the same path as you walked down an hour before. But the difference is the quality of your attentiveness, the mindfulness, the affectionate, tender, dedicated mindfulness that actually serves to awaken the moment. So what bare attention does is it really brings into consciousness everything that has been habitual and unconscious within ourselves. It brings into consciousness everything that has been obscured by confusion or by anxiety or agitation. Another aspect of bare attention is wise discernment. So what wise attention does is it helps us to discern the difference between our concept and what is actual. It helps us to discern the difference between our story about the moment and the simple truth of the moment. Again, one of my teachers of the past, really put this very, really simply. He said, the thought of your mother is not your mother. Now, we could kind of spread that out a little bit. You know, the thought of myself is not myself. You know, the thought that I have about you cannot possibly describe the entirety of who you are. My thought about anything cannot possibly capture the unfolding miracle of what a single life or what a single moment is. The thought of my body is not what my body is. The thought of myself is not myself. So another aspect of wise mindfulness that sits along bare attention is this element of clear comprehension. To understand the nature of what we are attending to. How all things arise and pass. How all things are constructed, are born of conditions, and they will pass away through changing conditions. Clear comprehension is also about being able to discern the difference between what is wholesome and what is unwholesome, what is skillful and what is unskillful, which is really another way of saying discerning moment to moment what leads to suffering and what leads to the end of suffering. Now these two together, bare attention and clear comprehension, are the basis of insight. They're the basis of understanding. They're the basis of freedom. So what I'd like to do now is to pick up on a few of the refrains that are stressed within the Satipatthana Sutta. Now, any of you who have ever read any of the discourses of the Buddha, and you might find that a weird thing to do, but if you've ever looked at them, you see it goes in for a lot of repetition. And it doesn't do that, I don't think, in order to put people to sleep in it. But I think a lot of the repetition is really meant to sort of plant these seeds so strongly in our minds that they're kind of naturalized. So that is why a few of these refrains are repeated over and over again through the sutta, because they emphasize the context and the attitude and the wisdom factors of wise mindfulness. And this is a very key attitude is a very crucial. I would say in our practice, attitude is most crucial. And it's one of the key elements in the transforming power of mindfulness. Now many of you, and I'm sure we've all seen that we tend to transfer our life attitudes directly into our meditative path. No surprise there. I mean, we wouldn't expect to sit down in a cushion and, you know, be Mother Teresa or the Buddha. You know, we tend to do this transference of attitudes from our life to our meditative path. You know, for example, if we tend to be a person in life who sort of, you know, stands on the bank and just sort of dabbles their toes in the water, a little afraid of taking risks or being wholehearted, we'll tend to do that same thing in our practice. You know, if we tend to be a person in life who has to have everything proved to us before we begin, we'll tend to do that in our practice. You know, if we tend to be a person who, you know, is incredibly intense and ambitious in our lives, we'll probably be a very intense and ambitious meditator. You know, if we tend to be a person who, you know, is more insecure, more doubtful in our life, you know, we'll probably think in our meditation that if we happen to run into a breath every now and then, that it's a really lucky accident. So we tend to do this, you know, we tend to do this transference over and over again. It should be no surprise to us. But this is one of the things that we examine in the practice, how we're just kind of transplanting identities and belief systems from one area of our life to another one. And we cultivate, actually, wise attitude. You know, sometimes once it was said that the world is full of choices, but sometimes the only choice we have is what attitude we will bring to this moment. So one line that is repeated as a description of the beginning of wise mindfulness is to contemplate the body as the body, to contemplate the body in the body, to contemplate feeling as feeling, to contemplate feeling in feeling, to contemplate the mind as a mind, in the mind. Having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Now, it's this last line which gets repeated endlessly. Having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Now, this is a very, very awkward translation. You know, most of us would read that and think, what on earth has that got to do with me? You know, covetousness and grief for the world. Well, an easier translation is we contemplate the body, mind, feeling, having put away craving and ill will. Having put away craving and ill will. Now the suggestion, or we might say the invitation here, is the invitation to lay down our world of preferences that govern so many of our habitual reactions and impulses. You know, I like this, I don't like this. I want this, I don't want this. This flatters or enhances me, this threatens me. Because these preferences within our practices, the craving and ill will, is actually what causes a very contracted and tight mind. It makes us a very uptight meditator. You know, I'll contemplate this, but not that. It is coming into the practice in an unconditional way, an unconditional welcome, an unconditional befriending. Most of it's not a big teaching for us to see in our life that when we're really caught in craving or when we're really caught in aversion or ill will, that these are very, very rarely the causes of contentment or peace. Mostly they are the causes of agitation and anxiety. So that is the encouragement in the beginning of the practice, to put down the tendencies towards craving and ill will. Now, this is a significant part of bare attention that allows us to open, that allows us to be intimate with what is, that allows us to be close, equally near, to everything that we contemplate in this world. Now, it seems to be stated negatively, and often this is actually one of the, kind of, I think, one of the weaknesses people see in this teaching, that things always seem to be stated negatively. You know, put down ill will and craving. You know, yes, I'll do that, you know, but it doesn't sound particularly uplifting, you know. But I think what's important to see that the putting down of ill will and craving doesn't leave a vacuum behind it. It doesn't leave an indifferent or apathetic space. It doesn't leave an empty space, the absence of craving or ill will. Instead, to put down craving and ill will is to put down the habit of fear, and it allows to come into being what the Buddha called two of the wise intentions, loving kindness and compassion. So learning to put down ill will and craving moment to moment is the proximate cause for the releasing of loving kindness and compassion. Bhavana. You know, the word in Pali for meditation is bhavana. And bhavana doesn't describe a sort of passive space. Bhavana means to cultivate, to bring into being. And what we are bringing into being moment to moment in our meditation practice are these intentions of loving kindness and compassion. That allows then each moment we approach to really be flavored by affection, by kindness, rather than by resistance. Pain and sorrow and suffering, instead of being greeted with aversion or anxiety, are embraced with compassion. So in a way, these kind of two intentions of loving kindness and compassion, they set the stage of this journey. They set the climate of the path. And it is that climate of the path that makes this path liberating. It's not just sitting around watching, observing, as if somehow this holds magical powers. It is how we are present, what we are bringing into being. We are bringing into being qualities not only of loving kindness and compassion, but also of fearlessness and equanimity. Now, I think for most of us, there is already a very, very profound insight involved in the willingness to put down our impulses towards craving and aversion. To acknowledge the futility and the painfulness of all the shoulding that we do in our lives. That my body, my mind, my emotions, my life should be different than it is. This moment should be different than it is. This is such a well-worn mantra in our life. Learning to put down resistance and fear, we begin to open just to the simple truth of the moment. We learn to find intimacy and connectedness. We learn to befriend. And this is a very profound shift in attitude in our hearts, to a mind that is most receptive to understanding, to a mind that is most dedicated to liberating the moment. I think one thing that it's a slight divergence, but one thing that is very important to understand in the Pali, in the language that the Buddha taught in, this is a language of verbs. It's not a language of nouns. It's a language of process, of verbs. So it doesn't talk about liberation. It talks about liberating. Huh? And very much talks about liberating the moment, loving the moment, befriending the moment, knowing the moment, understanding the moment. So none of these things are ever considered to be sort of, you know, results or outcomes or destinations, but instead very much ways of being in the present. Now, another line that is repeated through the discourse is the instruction, the encouragement to abide independent, not clinging to anything. To abide independent, not governed by anything. Now, the kind of independence that is really spoken about here is not a sort of independence of separation or disconnection or, you know, bringing up, you know, creating a sort of citadel of defensiveness. It is the independence of being ungoverned. Now, I think it is really helpful to explore what that means, to be ungoverned. You could begin in this moment by saying, at this time in your life, who or what is the gatekeeper of your happiness? Who or what at this moment in your life is the gatekeeper of your sense of freedom? Is it a person you struggle with? Is it a repetitive thought pattern? Is it an illness? Is it something that is happening in your life? Do you have the belief, I would be happy if only? Or I would be at peace if only? Being ungoverned, abiding independent, really means examining how true it is that any of these things, inwardly or outwardly, truly hold the keys to that gate of freedom and happiness. Or do we hold the keys to that gate within our own hands and within our own understanding? If we look at what governs us, we can see that it's not the thoughts or the emotions or the events or the people in our life that what truly creates that terrible feeling of being imprisoned or governed is actually within the realm of our clinging and grasping and holding. Within the realm of our resistance, our ill will, or our craving. That what we cling to in any moment forms the shape of our mind. If we cling to a thought, we become the thinker. If we cling to a pain, we become the sufferer. If we cling to an unfulfilled desire, we become the wanter. This is actually quite, you know, a certain subtlety in seeing this happening in our own consciousness. If we cling to a plan, we become the planner. If we cling to a role of teaching, we become the teacher. This actually makes us really quite contracted in our life. I mean, if we take that last example, suppose I was particularly identified with being a teacher, and every time I got on the bus, I felt the need to instruct everybody how to travel mindfully. Or I went into the supermarket and I had to instruct everybody how to stand in the line properly or check their fruit and vegetables through the counter properly. Or if I was identified with that role, I couldn't learn. I couldn't be taught. To really see this moment to moment in our life is actually really not as difficult as it sounds. Because it's not hard to find the places that we really cling to and grasp to, because for most of us, that's actually the place where we suffer the most. So if we want to have some clues to the whole mechanism of clinging and grasping, just look to the place where you're most struggling, where you're most suffering. One of the great, and I think the really wonderful and very liberating teachings of the Buddha, he says, what we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. What we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. And very often, the shape of our mind becomes the shape of our world. So this path is a practice of freedom, is learning through wise mindfulness really to soften all those places of clinging. First to know them, to see them, and to through the light of that seeing and investigation to begin to soften them. Now alongside loving kindness and compassion as two of the wise intentions that the Buddha spoke about, the third wise intention was the intention of renunciation. Now, Westerners hate this word. I have to say it. They really don't like it. You know, people say renunciation, you know, it's such a terrible word. Think of it differently. Release. Opening where there is closeness. Putting that, lightening the burden. Lightening the weight. Learning to let things pass as they will pass according to their own rhythm. Someone once said that renunciation is not trying to get rid of the things of this world, is that it is accepting that they will pass away. Whatever word we use for renunciation, we can also use different words for clinging. Contractedness, exclusiveness, tightness, being closed down. Clinging is a little bit like walking around with a sharp stone in a clenched fist. After a while you start to notice that it hurts, and after a while you start to notice that you can just open your hand. And again, this is, I would stress this again, this is a practice of the moment. It's not a practice of the future. It is really a practice of the moment. It's learning to cultivate a more spacious and inclusive presence. You can see that we sit and that we walk in a vast mandala of sights and sounds and thoughts and tastes and touches, feelings and thoughts. Every single moment of our life, they are arising and passing. They have, as I mentioned earlier today, their own feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. What clinging is it tends to be that on the basis of our reaction to those feeling tones, we tend to zoom in with our attention, highlight something, try to freeze it. It's like watching a movie and then putting it on pause. You know, we've frozen it in time. We've frozen it in a moment. And we call that clinging. You know, it's like if we were sitting here and you hear the birds and the dogs and, you know, the various sounds around you. And then if someone started playing a Jimi Hendrix song outside the door, you know, suddenly you would see perhaps your attention just zoom in, isolate and freeze that. For one person it would be a heaven realm, for another person it would be a hell realm. You know, but that is what clinging is. It is that sense of isolating. And we are governed by what we cling to. We see that over and over again. So with mindfulness, we learn really to be aware of all of those moments when our world starts to shrink. How do we know we're clinging? Because in that moment, there's an absence of any genuine sense of freedom. And within those moments, that's actually where we're learning to abide independent, not governed by anything. Now the third refrain that is repeated endlessly, just like this talk is going on endlessly, is to contemplate the body in the body, feeling in feeling, mind in mind. And again, this is a radical shift towards non-identification. And the Buddha says to contemplate to the extent that is necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. Now, this bare knowledge and mindfulness is the key part, because it's an invitation to a sort of radical simplicity, to know the difference between our narration about what is happening and what is actually happening, the story we are telling about it. I mean, we can see as human beings, we tend to be storytelling machines. We only need one sight and we could write a book. One sound and we have chapters being endlessly written about that one sound in our minds. That we tend to lay this narration, this narrative, upon everything and upon ourselves. And it is a way of making the world fixed and solid. It's a way of conclusion. We say, I know, but what we know is what we think about something. And that is often very different from what is actually true about what is being connected with. A world which is always unfolding. If you take an example, you know, you sit and you know you're very, very concentrated, you're very focused, and then suddenly your knee starts to ache. Your attention goes there. What's actually happening there is an unpleasant sensation. But you see so quickly the story go on it. Oh no, it's happening again, you know. Every moment of enlightenment gets sabotaged by this knee. Oh, it's always been like that in my life. Every time on the precipice of something, you know, something bad happens. It's because I'm this kind of person, you know. I'm an unfortunate person, you know. And this was a simple sensation in the knee. You know, we've written a whole book about it. What mindfulness is, what wise mindfulness, to know something to the extent that is necessary for bare knowledge as mindfulness is to know a sensation as a sensation, a sound as a sound, a thought as a thought, a feeling as a feeling. In some crucial way, our capacity to deepen as human beings relies upon our capacity to be surprised, to come more into a place of unknowing rather than fixing. And we see often what our narratives do is they do fix, they do solidify. It is almost to say we have learned all that we can learn, understood everything all we can understand about this moment because we have a story about it. Then it's not so easy to be surprised, is it? The art of bare attention. When we listen underneath our own stories, what we're often listening to is actually the story of life. Life being able to tell us its story. Our body being able to tell us its story. Our feelings being able to tell their story to us. Once we have let go of that compulsion to be superimposing our own story upon everything around us. And one story that life continues to teach us, if we listen, is a universal story. And it is the story of change, the story of impermanence. And throughout the Satipatthana Sutta, there is the encouragement to really listen to that story in all things, that just as things arise, so too they will pass. Sometimes we use those words, we're afraid something's going to last forever, or we're afraid something doesn't last long enough. But nothing lasts forever. Even the most difficult situation, the most difficult thought, even if you tried your hardest, you cannot make it last forever. It is a universal story that is intended to somehow lighten, bring more space into our relationship with all that is difficult. It's not intended to somehow depress us or, you know, make the world into bad news, but to really see, to align ourselves with the truth of how life is. Arising, passing, changing, moment to moment, ungraspable, uncontrollable. Within that, we can find a certain spaciousness of being, a generosity of being, where we live aligned and in harmony with the way things are, rather than living somehow separate, trying to superimpose our will or our fears upon how things are. All the ideas of continuity in the light of impermanence feel a little bit more transparent. The continuity of our views, the continuity of ourself, the continuity of our assumptions, they're somehow all brought into a different light of questioning. Now, Jnanapanika put this path of mindfulness in a very simple way. He says, first is to know the mind, to know the heart, to know the body, to know the moment. He said, second is to shape the mind. To shape the mind with ethics, with kindness, with compassion, with wise intention. And he said, the third is to free the mind, to free the heart, to liberate the mind and heart through understanding. And the liberated mind is really the fruit or the fruition of the path of wise mindfulness. If we could just have a moment quietly together, then have a moment stretch.